Hello, welcome and thank you for joining us and listening to our podcast, The God Beyond the Bible. Our podcast is released weekly each Friday. The content of each episode is based on the questions and curiosities we all have about God and the Bible. Many of our topics are considered taboo in the minds of the mainstream church. You will find our discussions to be, I think, refreshing and often far from traditional. But we don't just skirt around these complex issues, but confront them head on, and not in the way you're used to hearing them discussed on typical Christian talk shows. I'm Alan Rowland, creator and host of The God Beyond the Bible. As of the launch of this podcast, I've been a pastor for more than 35 years. My co-host is my daughter, Trayson, and our engineer co-producer is my daughter, Tabitha. Our mission is to encourage our audience, along with us, to open our minds to the reality that God is simply too big to be fully explored or experienced by the reading and studying of a single ancient work. In short, the Bible's not the sum of God, and to think this is to limit what He has done, is doing, and what He will do in our future. So with introductions made, thank you for listening, and let's dive into the topic of the day. And welcome, listeners, to God Beyond the Bible, episode number 59. I just want to thank each of you for your open-minded support by listening to our little podcast. As we've said before, and as you know if you've been even a casual listener, we're a podcast that is solely self-financed and supported by the blessings of being able to work with our own hands. Yes. We don't beg for money. We don't nag you to like, share, subscribe, or what are any of those other things people ask you to do. We're confident that this allows us to be true to our mission of seeking truth. Now, when money gets involved, it changes the dynamic of any project or mission. We're also confident that each of you know someone who might be enlightened and benefit from our discussions, and possibly you'll feel led to share us with those people. Well, that's how our listening audience has grown so far, and we expect it to continue. We believe there are a lot of spiritual seekers out there, folks like us, who know in our spirit that there's much more to this force we call God and are not satisfied with the stock answers that many in the believing community have been programmed to give us.
That's right. And with that somewhat lengthy introduction, Trayson, we got any shout-outs?
Our shout-outs this week are to Kellen, Jessica, and Angie.
All right. Thanks, guys. And you have our quote also?
Yeah. I do. Our quote of the week is actually a song lyric that's kind of been stuck in my head for a few weeks. But it's, wherever you are, whatever you did, it's a page in your book, but it isn't the end. And it's from the song Prodigal by the Sidewalk Prophets.
Okay.
Good deal.
Don't know who they are, but I like that. Okay, last episode, number 58, we briefly explored...
58.
Number
I'm 58, sorry.
Yeah. Here, don't get me mixed up. Last episode, number 58, we briefly explored an approximate 400-year period between the close of the Old Testament book of Malachi and the opening of the New Testament with Matthew's gospel account. We discovered that period to be anything but silent. In fact, there was a lot going on that set the stage for the birth and the life of Jesus. And it was well documented, both secularly and biblically. And if one's willing and wants to, they can visit the books of Maccabees. And as we said in the episode, we owe the Catholic Church a big debt of thanks for seeing the need to preserve these books. I'm sure some others may have, but I know they mainly sought to preserve them.
Okay, so in this episode, we're going to build on that platform that we established in last week's episode on the silent period.
So let's dive into segment one. Our premise for this week's episode is this. If the Bible, as we know it, was silent during such an important period as the 400 years that bridged the gap between the Old and New Testaments, so much that our scholars chose to dub it the silent period or the silent era, as some call it, what then will future generations call this 2,000-year period since the close of the New Testament? Or better yet, what are we calling it now?
Well, this brings us to ponder the question, is God doing something? Is God doing anything? What is He doing? And has anyone preserved it for future generations of the faith seekers? Has God really said all He has to say to His creation? Is He still the living God?
You know, we must consider that God may not be silent at all, but that we have, in essence, silenced Him by declaring that this single historic work is, as we have said many times before, the sum of God.
We should at least consider that the collection of works that we call the Bible was all written in a single period of time spanning less than 1,500 years. To clarify that statement, let's break it down. Even though it covers a historical period of about 4,000 years, that is, from Adam until about 35 years past Christ's crucifixion and resurrection, Moses, who we are told recorded at least the first five books of the Old Testament, did not arrive on the scene until approximately 1300 BC. So if we add 70 more years to that, which will cover the birth of Christ through the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, that is, at 70 AD, at most, we have a book compiled in a short period of less than 1400 years.
Well, and as we have spent many episodes and exhausted much time researching and sharing with our listeners, it has been man, not God, who has edited, discarded, made additions to, and decided to elevate this single collection of works to the status of God's holy word, and to declare it complete for all eternity. None of God's dealings with mankind to ever be preserved again. The point is, we've now been in the second longest period of inspirational silence since that some 2,700 year period before Moses.
Wow. So we acknowledge that at first listen, it feels like we are trampling on sacred ground, but nothing could be farther from the truth. Let's think about it rationally and logically. We know that God was working and people were being inspired and doing miraculous things in his name, even in those periods where no one, as far as we know, was recording it. For instance, we're all pretty comfortable with the story of the Great Flood. We'll even talk about the faithfulness of Noah, yet the only account we have of Noah's faithful endeavor wasn't preserved for us until some 1,500 years after the fact.
And last week, we discovered that 400-year period that our modern Bible has remained completely silent about is one of the most important periods of time and events leading up to the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ. And even though there were inspired people doing incredibly miraculous things in the name of God, and even though someone was recording and preserving it, through time, some groups of people determined that it somehow didn't qualify as information worthy of preserving and sharing. Someone decided it didn't have enough spiritual or historical value to keep it alive, yet, as we've discovered, it's incredibly valuable to understand that transitional period.
And with that thought, please allow us to pause, regroup, and return with part two of episode 59 of God Beyond the Bible.
Okay, welcome back, Seekers, to part two of episode 59 of God Beyond the Bible. Let's jump right back into our discussion on what we are to make of this 2,000-year period of biblical silence between the siege of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD.
And let us say that again, like the 400-year period between the Old and New Testament, we believe God has been very active and very much inspiring men and women of every generation. So let's pause and ask a question here. Do you think that for us to recognize and acknowledge God's presence and activity in our modern world, we, as products of organized religion, need to step back and rethink what we think we know about God? And even possibly deprogram or detox our minds and spirits of much of what's been drilled into us concerning who God is and our relationship to him?
And, you know, I think just because you do that, it doesn't mean that
you haven't lost your faith.
No, you
it's
haven't.
It's not, don't mean you've lost
That's
your
faith.
That's
not what it's about.
In fact, it might be the period when your faith begins. And I know there's another word that they use. What is it besides deprogram or detox?
Deconstruct.
Deconstruct. Yeah, is that the word they're using?
That's the word that for.
And you start seeing that more and more. You're seeing more and more people saying, I had to step back. I had to deconstruct. I had to rethink everything I've been told and think, Now, why do I believe that? Do I believe that because, yes, because in my spirit I received that from reading or whatever myself? Or is it because I was told that's how it is?
Well, and you know, and we as Christians, you know, we say that, well, the difference between us and other religions is we serve a living God. But if we're going to say that and then say that he hasn't done anything since the Bible times, is it really any different than serving a...
No, and I found out it's more about, it's really all about internals and externals. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are depending on externals to lead them in their spiritual life. And you can't do that. Spirituality is internal. And I think we're living in the age of where we're supposed to be looking internally, you know, Holy Spirit internally. And we're not. We're just seeking out. We're listening to all the voices outside. Mm-hmm. We're hearing all of these voices yelling at us outside. Believe that this is what it... And I think the little small still voice inside gets shouted down.
But, you know, and I have to say this because it's something that's really bothered me through my deconstruction, is I've realized that I have heard so many people throughout my life who warn you not to trust that still small voice in you because it might not really be that voice that you think it is.
Well, I get so sick of that. That may not be the Spirit of God telling you that. That may be the spirit of the... Well, because, you know, he can sound just like he can. People.
And let me tell you that I've never had anything sound remotely like that voice of the Spirit speaking to me. No. Just for those of you who question out there, I always know when it's that voice, especially when I started coming out of the confusion of whether it was that voice or not.
Mm-hmm. If we continue to keep God confined to a single 1400 or 1500 year period of time, and as that period becomes more and more distant with each passing decade, is the modern Christian movement sealing its fate? Yes. Is it being perceived as less and less relevant to real people in real life situations today?
It's already happening. Mm-hmm. We are treating a, like Tabby was saying, we are treating a real and living God no different than the wooden statues that the Israelites were always in trouble for putting on there.
And I've heard people say, I pray and I don't think my prayers get past the ceiling. As though the prayers have to go somewhere.
I have said that. I feel like they're just falling on the wind. I shouldn't be sending those prayers out anywhere. They're right here.
Yeah, we're not sending them anywhere. We're connected, guys. Exactly. It's Wi-Fi connected. we're all connected all the time. It's a dependable Wi-Fi. It's fast.
But that goes back to depending on externals. Yeah. I mean, everything does.
It's external. I almost did an episode on externals and internals. Mm-hmm. A lot of people depend on externals.
Yes.
Their walk is based on externals. Mm-hmm. The church, everybody, a lot of people are coming to the church. It must be doing the right thing. A lot of people are doing this. It must mm-hmm. be, see, externals instead of seeking out inside. Am I where I need to be? I think you're three, Tabitha.
Okay. Well, these are difficult questions, but, you know, they are necessary if the Christian faith is going to continue to be a source of light and a force of good in future generations. It must become more than merely an historical study of faith at work in a period long past. There are those who say that the way we do it must not change, yet they seem to be totally ignorant of the constant change and evolution of the faith in just the past 500 years since the Reformation, not to mention the 1500 years of turmoil and religious wars and crusades that our Christian religion today has been greatly influenced by.
So what do you guys think? Are we on the threshold of another Reformation?
I think it's a revolution.
If
Reformation was what Martin Luther did, mm-hmm. then we need revolution.
Yes, we do.
And that means absolute departure from... Oh, that's apostasy. Absolute departure. No, I mean from the traditions that we have adopted for truths.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I have to say, too, guys, I think it's already started. I don't think we're on the threshold anymore. I think we've already stepped through the door, and it's starting.
And I'm hearing it from people that aren't even familiar with this podcast.
Yes.
I'm hearing it from people that I'm not influencing by what I'm saying or what we're saying. There's people that's coming to say, you know, I can just see it. And, of course, you know, I don't even want to talk about the C word, but, you know, now... People, you know, now even the religious congregations are closing down and not having, you know, religious. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you know what? It's not hard to get people not to come.
True.
It's not very hard to get folks not to come.
Let's step a little bit deeper into that question.
Okay.
One really has to consider, if the modern organized Protestant church has evolved into the very system that it rose up against and endeavored to separate itself from a mere 500 years ago.
I think it did. I really mm-hmm. think we had no other pattern.
No.
Think about it. And we're going to talk about that.
But we took it right, as we'll talk about. But we took it right from the Jewish temple.
Well, yeah,
just
yeah.
The
Catholic
the
folks took it right after the Jewish yes. temple, rebuilt the, you know, just really all that. But what were the objections to the Catholic Church that prompted Martin Luther's 95 Theses that legend tells us he nailed to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany? Now, somebody's going to say, wait, that's not legend. Yeah, it is. There's no documentation that ever happened.
You mean we don't still have the 95 Theses?
I tried to find. Did anybody try to find what they were exactly?
I did. There, you can Google it, and they will pop up.
I did, but I never could get them to blow up. Somebody just had a copy thing, and I couldn't get it to look. It seems that Luther's main objection was that of the churches having inserted itself into the God-man relationship as the authority on what or who was acceptable to God. Is that fair?
Yes.
And it seems that his main complaint was over the indulgences or the certificates of forgiveness that a family member could purchase to shorten a loved one's period in purgatory.
Mm-hmm. Every time a coin rings, a soul from purgatory springs.
But I will say this, because if I was reading through it and if I understood it right, Martin Luther did, though, kind of place the Bible as the ultimate authority.
Oh, he did. Yeah, he sure did. So he,
and while he had some good points, I think he was still a little misguided.
Well, he was a Catholic priest.
Right.
I mean, he was what a monk, not a monk, but he was studying for priesthood. What is that called?
I thought they were just priests.
I don't know. But anyway, he was studying for the priesthood. And I think one of the things of the priesthood then had to be, you had to hand, I think you had to translate, I don't know if you had to, or at least copy the Bible.
Oh, wow.
I think one of the things that we tend to forget, though, in Martin Luther's defense, and we have these great leaps forward throughout religious history mm-hmm. where God really pulls us forward. But then it's like we just dig our heels in and go, no farther. We've gone as far as we're going to go.
Sometimes when you start getting, with anything, you start getting outside your comfort zone and it gets a little scary. You tend to retreat back into what you've always known.
We get the Hebrew children syndrome as they were in the wilderness. We were better off where we were. What'd you do? Bring us out here to starve to death? Bring us out here to starve of water?
You should have left us in Egypt.
At least we had food and water in Egypt. We're not good about leaving Egypt. We don't like to get out of Egypt. It's how God's found man likes Egypt.
Yeah. So to sum it up very simply, it was the abuse of the church's self-proclaimed power and authority to control the spiritual pursuits of the people and the use of that perceived authority and power for financial gain. Might one perceive the modern Protestant church as being guilty of inserting itself into the God-man equation and also quite interested in the financial gain that is associated with its position?
I'll just let everybody in their own mind answer that question. You know what my opinion is.
right. And I have to. I have to say that I have been really, really guilty of sort of, in my mind, pushing the church into that spot of, well, I have to be going to church. I have to be doing this or God's not going to be.
Well, it comes down that it's all the way back to Egypt, actually.
Yeah.
That belief in those gods that they had to be appeased and we've got to do this to appease. And it's really amazing to me. And if you ever listen to our tithing or one on the tithe, mm-hmm. it's amazing to me that one thing all the denominations will agree on is that tithe thing.
Oh, yeah.
And even the church with the greatest that I've been in contact with, that are the greatest proponents of the grace covenant that mm-hmm. we're under, they'll steal that one law.
They'll bring it.
That one tithing law, they'll roll that tithing law forward, yeah.
Well, as we contemplate the questions we raised in this segment, please allow us to pause and regroup, and we'll return with our third and final segment of episode 59 of God Beyond the Bible.
Welcome back, listeners. Today we're entertaining the thought along the lines of, if the 400-year period between the Old and New Testaments of our modern Bible are dubbed the silent period, what might one classify the 2,000 years since?
And, you know, we pointed out in part two how the Christian religion has been in a constant state of turmoil and change from the beginning, and no single particular attempt at organizing the people of Christian faith has proven to be terribly successful. And by all accounts, anyone who is objectively observing the organized Christian religion today can sense that we are indeed once again on the threshold of unprecedented change.
You must have that thing that got in me.
I guess.
And there may be a lesson to be learned in all of this. Someone said that those who do not learn from the mistakes of history are doomed to repeat them. And if you think about it, the problem is that history has shown us that man wants to organize so that he can control. And with the structure of the organization, it always seems to provide the opportunity for a few to be elevated to positions of authority and control. And it usually results in the opportunity for financial gain.
Now, does that sound harsh?
I don't think so.
It's the truth, though.
It's truth.
It's just the truth. It's just the unblemished truth. Don't get me wrong. We talked about this when we talked about the church and money. If you're part of an organization that's decided to buy a building, I don't care if it's a church or a fishing club or whatever it is, you're going to have to, if you've obligated yourself, you're going to have to, that's understandable. But my thing has always been, that's the source of 90% of the problems in the organized church is the building and the finances.
Well, and it's so funny because you can, any Christian will say, can look at secular organizations and see the problem. But it's almost like we get these blinders on, and it's not condemning faith. It's just, no, this is not working.
It's not
working. There has to be a better way.
This grab for power, wealth, and control is as old as history itself. And to be honest, God doesn't seem to take too much pleasure in this human tendency, if history is any indicator. Just recall the event in Genesis of the Tower of Babel. This was a clear attempt to organize the masses, use the organizations as a means to control the masses, and though we don't have all the details, what are the odds that those behind the organization were going to occupy the top positions, directing the movements and activities of the organization? And one might be safe to wager there was going to be some personal and financial gain involved. And by the way, it doesn't seem that God was too impressed by that attempt.
One of my favorite quotes from... Honestly, I wasn't even sure which Rob Bell book it was because I've read several. But one of his quotes is, empire is always anti-God.
And it is.
Yes, it is.
And that's, people don't like to hear that.
No, but that's what we've created in some of these organizations.
What have we said over and over? The church is one organization that does not need to be based on big business and government. But it is. It's modeled after big business and government.
You know, one may safely conclude that Jesus came to break up another group of people who had jockeyed themselves into a position of organized control over the masses. They were, of course, the Jews of Jesus' day. The Pharisees and others who held elevated positions in the organized religion of that day walked the streets and literally judged and controlled every aspect of the lives of the people subject to their authority and control. And might we mention, they enjoyed great financial compensation to boot. Jesus came warning them that their reign of power and control over the people was coming to an end. And an end it did.
Yes.
In 70 AD, the city was seized and the temple was completely and utterly destroyed, bringing a literal fulfillment to Jesus' prophetic statement 35 years earlier that not one stone would be left standing on top of the other.
So, if we are to use history as a teacher, one might conclude that God wasn't pleased with the direction that the organized religion had taken. By inserting themselves into the God and man equation, men developed a way to control other people and to gain from it. When we study the period immediately following the destruction of the temple, ending the old covenant between God and the nation of Israel, and leaving only the new covenant that Jesus spoke of, as he lifted his cup on the night of his betrayal and arrest, it was a period where mankind was allowed to pursue God on a personal level. However, it didn't take long for man to seize the opportunity to reorganize the scattered factions of faith back under a single authority.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that brick by brick, man has rebuilt the same old system of intervening in the God-man relationship? organizing a system to control the God-man relationship, and yes, once again, extracting personal and financial gain for a select few holding elevated positions in the organization.
Yes.
And it sounds really harsh, guys, when you just say it like that. I'm saying, you'd be surprised of the people that are afraid to say these things because they're part of the organized church, and there no one's, it's almost like you guys are familiar, I've used this phrase before, you guys are familiar with the story of the Emperor's New Clothes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, it's, I just see that so clearly that just no one, people are thinking it, but no one will say it.
And I've been guilty on the other side too of, well, I know that you believe, but you really need to find a church that you can go to and get involved. Yeah.
And well, and I think that that kind of gives us, and a lot of people have that same perspective that we do. We've been on both sides.
Sure.
You know, it's not that we're just standing back pointing our finger.
Yeah.
We've been those people.
I think we have. Yeah, the right. I think I have the right to make criticisms because I'm criticizing myself
exactly
in the process. So I'm able to do that. Well, who's number seven there?
That would be me.
Okay.
So will a true reformation only come when we figure out a way to engage one another spiritually, to fellowship and share our personal experiences with God without repeating the same cycle of self-elevation and greed? And what of God being silent? Are we on the threshold of coming to a place that we allow God to communicate and inspire us outside the limitations of the selected recorded experiences of only a few people in a single brief period of human history?
I can say for myself that I have had more communion with the Creator in the last few years than I ever have in my life.
Right.
And it's all been on a personal level. It's not been through a church or an organized anything. It's just been that one-on-one sort of communication. And guys, it's life-changing.
I think we mentioned the words of Jesus in the last couple of episodes, one of them, where he was telling the Samaritan woman, you know, she was asking, now, I'm confused. Do we worship on the mountain that you guys say we worship on, or do we worship on the mountain that my ancestors say we need to worship on? And Jesus said, you know the rest of it. The time will come. In fact, now he is, where those who worship God will worship him in spirit and in truth.
Yep.
So one must ask, is God really in us as he promised to be under this new covenant? When Jesus promised that once he had ascended and the Holy Spirit came and indwelt in the common man, that we would have an eternal guide that would show us all things and eliminate the need for any man to teach us.
And that's kind of amazing that Jesus would say that. But you look, Jesus was a rebel about this. Mm-hmm. You know, people, well, they were going to the temple, and he was going out in the field. You know, the temple, you know, they had, but he would go out in the field and there'd be 5,000 men. So we're going to assume there's probably 10,000 or more people there that would come out on the hillside to hear him. You just can't do that.
Right.
You know. You just can't do that. Well, what are we to make of the accounts of Jesus' teachings that have been disqualified because they were believed to be written after the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple? If the destruction of the temple marked the end of the old covenant, shouldn't that have been a beginning point for some new inspiration?
I would think so.
You know, that's really what they hold against the Gospel of Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
They said, no, that didn't show up till sometime in the second century. So that was written after much. Well, the truth of it is, all of the Gospels were written after the fact.
Yeah.
Nobody was recording. I hear a phone ringing. No one was recording that those events, you know.
Right. And I think we very much have to remind ourselves. We need to remind ourselves, sorry about that, we had to pause for just a second if you hear it. I think that we need to remind ourselves that we went, what was it, 1,500 years between Moses and Adam, and those stories were written down. So really, in the grand scheme of things, 100 or so years is not that long between, I'm going to tell you these things that this great guy that we heard said, and you pass them on to your kids, and then they write them down.
Actually, I'm going to correct you on something. You meant to say this, but it was 1,500 years between Adam and Noah, and then it was another 1,500 years before Moses wrote any of it
down. Exactly.
I guess I don't understand. And why are we so happy to just be in this, like, limbo. Like, the Bible, okay, the Bible ended everything, and now we're just, the next thing that's going to happen is Jesus coming back, and it's like there's nothing in between that for us to...
Well, no, and you'll ask people that question. I'll say, yeah, but that's for us to be winning people. We need to be winning souls. By the way, next week, we're going to be talking about salvation. Right. We never have, and it's going to be our episode next week on salvation, so be sure to be with us.
Okay, so why must we gauge the depth of inspiration by the number of people that we can get to assemble and organize under one creed? In our desire to recreate the old external system, have we deprived ourselves of a real personal relationship based on God leading and inspiring us from within?
We have. And I think I want to take that one step farther. I know that I have.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Absolutely. And I think we have even tainted the name God with mm-hmm. some of the things. I find myself, the more that I deconstruct, I find myself finding new names to refer to God as.
Mainly because it's not that what we've done, it's that we've made this such a generic.
Yes.
It's so generic. It has no personal. Well, when you just say God.
And that's what I was talking to someone about that today, how I hate to use the term God because when I say it, it's been ingrained in me that God is something that's like way out there that I have really real contact with, but he's not. I mean, you know.
In the Greek, he was theos. The best that they could, that's where we get theology. Mm-hmm. But he was theos, and it was what? The exceeding great and good force.
Yes, and I love that.
And that's as close as they could define God. But why do we want to define him in all these other terms now? We just, you know, and really, like you say, we've done damage and we've really made using the word God really generic.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps the real tragedy is that we've been convinced that we cannot learn to recognize, listen for, and utilize that internal voice that the Most High promises as a guide for our relationship with him and a life compass.
Yeah, and who's convincing us of that? The organizations, the church is saying, you've got to have us to tell you.
I'll let you know if it's the real voice or not.
Yeah, tell you whether it's the voice. Are we ready to conclude?
I think so.
The way we pursue, relate to, and respond to this exceeding great and good force we call God is destined for change. I'm convinced that he's not somewhere in the past beckoning us to come back to a former time and reinvent an external system of rules and sacrifices to experience him. Instead, I believe he's in front of us, ahead of us, holding out his hands like a loving father, encouraging his child to stand and take those first steps toward his strong, safe, and loving arms.
Always love that picture. As always, until next time, God's grace, peace, and love be on, in, and radiate out from each of you, our fellow seekers, from all of us here at God Beyond the Bible.
Did you enjoy listening to God Beyond the Bible? Do you have an idea for an episode? Connect with us today. Visit our website at godbeyondthebible.com, all one word, or send us an email at email@godbeyondthebible.com, or you can visit us on Facebook. Just type God Beyond the Bible into the search bar.